submission is PE1487 by Mark Gordon and Secretary of Scotland on religious observance in schools. Members have note from the clerk and the SMICE briefing. And also we've had a submission from the Church of Scotland. Could I welcome the petitioner, Mark Gordon, and also Caroline Lynch, who's the Secretary of the Secretary of Scotland, to our meeting today. I understand that you wish to share a joint presentation. Probably we're a bit behind time, which I apologise for, so perhaps if you could keep it to around 3 minutes, that would be very useful. Who wants to start?
As brief as possible.
Thank
for you.
I'll start with Caroline Lynch then, if I could.
Okay. Well, our petition basically seeks to change the Education Scotland Act of 1980, which sets the default position as every child is opted into religious observance in schools and parents have a statutory right to withdraw should they wish to do so. We wish to have an active and meaningful choice for parents of whether or not they wish to participate in religious observance or whether they send their child into a suitable and meaningful alternative activity. In essence, we want you to ask parents first. Our petition is seeking a simple solution to a serious problem that is caused by the law not working as intended. And that is what we're going to show you today. We're going to show you the testimony that we receive from parents telling us what's really happening on the ground. Now, to start this off, I'd like to introduce you to Mark Gordon, who started the ball rolling with this with his own personal experiences, which he'll tell you about.
So, ladies and gentlemen of the committee, personal experience of opting my daughter out of religious observance was indeed the trigger to raising this petition. It became abundantly clear from discussions with the school, analysis of legislation and of the prevalence of belief in the population, discussion with others, that many parents would not want to take the stand that I had. Having decided to act, we sought the experiences of other parents, some of which we hope to present to you in an additional submission afterwards. And if you would permit me, please, to give you a small sample of what we found. We have testimony from parents whose children have been opted out, being left unattended in corridors with little meaningful to do. Children effectively being chastised for their parents' decision to opt out. Children being told to carry out menial tasks. Believe it or not, sharpening pencils and cleaning a library was one of these. Parents being considered difficult because they dared to question a head teacher's wisdom. Parents being told actually there was no right to withdraw. Parents having to seek legal advice because a school couldn't or wouldn't provide acceptable alternative activities. Parents being told that alternative activities such as humanist material would categorically not be allowed. A teenage pupil who had a right to withdraw himself being forcibly prevented from leaving religious observance that he objected to. And crucially, evidence that despite very recent regulations, this is the 2012 regulations on school placements, outlining the correct requirement for school handbooks to lay out in writing the parental right to withdraw. We found a very large percentage of school handbooks did not as yet contain this information. Now, to my daughter, she is well treated, and in my opinion, it's a very good school. But she has reported, as others have, that she's been sitting in the school office with the school secretary during religious assemblies, and more recently was taken against my written instructions to a church service. And maybe not every parent is as confident as I am to make a stand for what is the right thing to do. Perhaps most parents might not wish their children to be exposed to some aspects of Christian religious observance, and perhaps they just didn't feel able to opt out. They didn't feel able to address the issue, to face up to the authority of the school, to risk their child being ostracised by non-conformance, or perhaps just that they feared damaging an otherwise healthy parent-teacher relationship. So my conclusion was that the law was no longer in accordance with the demographic of Scotland, which has changed significantly since the last review. There's a built-in unfairness, despite the Religious Observance Review Group stating that religious observance should not be of a confessional nature. We know from testimony that it is. Existing legislation makes the removal of religious observance, even from a single school, extremely difficult. It requires a poll of the local authority electorate, and this is not what we seek, because this would only end up in patchy provision across the country. On the contrary, it might well be that our petition, if successful, would actually strengthen religious observance through discussion. So because of all of this, we are here today presenting our petition. Caroline?
Thank you very much for your joint presentation. You've touched on evidence and you give some examples which are very useful, but do you have comprehensive Scotland-wide evidence of the views of pupils, parents or staff?
We've brought that with us today. We have testimony from parents and from teachers and from course designers and from students, all telling of what their experiences are. And these experiences vary widely. We're not saying that every single school is failing, but we're saying that there is failure endemic throughout the school system on this. The law basically makes five provisions, that there are six opportunities for religious observance throughout the year as a minimum, that every parent has a statutory right to withdraw, they must be informed of this right to withdraw, and they must be given sufficient information on which to base their decision about whether or not to withdraw, that if the statutory right to withdraw is actually taken up, there must be a suitable, meaningful alternative activity in place for that child so that they're not penalised, that no child should be disadvantaged by choosing to withdraw from religious observance. There are failures in all of these areas across the board. It's endemic. It's happening everywhere. And that's why the law needs to be urgently reformed, in our opinion.
Thank you. And if you've not done it already, perhaps we could have look at that evidence.
Absolutely.
So we can circle it. Chip Brody?
Yes. Good afternoon. I'm intrigued by, and perhaps may somewhat agree with the comment that you made, Mr. Gordon. Mr. Gordon referenced this change may strengthen religious observance. How do you come to that?
We think that it's making it a more inclusive process. It's something that parents and children would positively opt to get involved in. I think there are possibly a lot of kids who don't actually want to be there.
Thank you. Good afternoon. I suppose I can only play devil's advocate with this petition, if you don't mind the contradiction in the sentiment underpinning that statement. I have no religious convictions myself, but I think you've actually made a very good case this morning for ending the opt-out provision, in the sense that clearly you feel there is no alternative meaningful activity taking place, but I don't understand the connection between... I mean, I went to a school where I had to attend religious education or observance. My parents very much encouraged in me an independent attitude. Therefore, on not just this, but on subjects such as politics, on subjects such as history, on a whole range of other areas, whatever I was taught at school, we would challenge in the home, and I would come ultimately to an independent view on matters which are ultimately subjective or of faith. And it seems to me that, in a sense, by imposing a view that nobody should be exposed to any kind of religious education, that in its sense is a rather doctrinal approach, when it's perfectly surely open to parents to encourage a degree of independent thinking by challenging whatever it is that their children have been exposed to. And so I don't necessarily equate participation and attendance and conviction in all of this as being one and the same thing. And so I'm not fundamentally, ultimately, terribly sure of what the great damage is that is being done, unless children are not being encouraged by their parents or their schools to evolve any kind of ability to assess, judge, and evaluate independent information on an independent basis.
There are several points in that. First of all, our religious education is split into two areas, religious and moral education and religious observance. Religious and moral education is the part where we're teaching about what religion is, what the beliefs are of the different groups, and we have absolutely no issue with that. That is information that everybody needs to have at least a basic understanding of in order to function in our world. Religious observance, on the other hand, is active participation within religion. And while there are guidances in place to say what this should be, and that it should be non-denominational and inclusive, and that it shouldn't contravene anyone's personal faith stance. The reality on the ground is that this is, in most cases, Christian worship, and we can give you dozens and dozens of examples. Just yesterday, I got a phone call from a parent who was very angry and very distressed because his five-year-old son has brought home two Young Earth creationist books that had been given to him during religious observance. And these books directly state that their aim is to debunk Scottish education or scientific education in general. They talk about exposing the myth of evolution. This is the kind of material that is making its way into our schools under the auspices of religious observance. We've got evidence of prayer spaces being used for faith healings, of incurable conditions. This is being done without parental knowledge and consent, and this is amongst the reasons why we are so concerned. My five-year-old son had nightmares for months because he was told that Jesus was having nails hammered through his flesh to save him. We've got teachers telling us that children are being told that they're sinners, and unless they accept God, they're going to go to hell. We have Muslims who are being asked to participate in praying to God, same as Jews and Buddhists and all sorts of people who are being asked to pray to a Christian God, and that is anathema to their own personal stance. And parents are not being informed that they can opt out. They're, in some cases, being prevented from exercising that right. We've got a lady at the moment whose daughter has been threatened with expulsion from her school if she exercises the right to opt out. These are the kind of things that are going on, and at the moment, there's very little protection for the parents in there because the abuse of this is so endemic. It's across the system. It's happening all over the place.
So I follow a lot of that, and what you talk of there is a certain evangelical fanaticism, which I think would be of a concern not just to the pupils who had opted out, but to the pupils who were actually being remaining within the environment. But I still would maintain that there's a difference between attending a religious observance event and participating in it. I mean, I have to say I have done plenty of the former, of exactly that. I've attended, I haven't participated.
I think it behoves us to offer the children protection rather than just say, well, it's up to the child to figure this out. And we're talking about five-year-olds here. And I think it would behove us to give the child protection.
In addition,
well, I wasn't protected. I was encouraged to think independently and to challenge the views that were expressed to me. And that is what I did. And in so doing, came to what I am comfortable with as a rational judgment, with which I can live and which I can understand. I'm not quite sure how protecting, as you put it, people from hearing any alternative point of view is to do them any service at all.
But it's not about protecting them from hearing an alternative point of view. They will hear alternative points of view throughout their education. They will hear about them in religious and moral education. It's about participating and the freedom to choose what your faith is and to participate in it freely. That's a point of human rights. And one of the points that we raise is that in not allowing parents to choose how their children participate in religious observance freely, not allowing them to exercise that judgment as we should, we're directly contravening human rights law. It's Article 18.4 of the International Covenant of Civil and Political Rights, which we have opted into and ratified. And it states that parents have the right to raise their children and have them educated in accordance with their beliefs. And we're breaching that.
Okay, thank you,
Convener. I'm sorry, I'm really short of time now. Does any member have any other points? John Wilson.
Just a brief question to ask Ms Lynch and Mr Gordon. I'm assuming that you are wanting, if you wanted this to go ahead, this would only apply to non-denominational schools in Scotland.
Not at all. It would be all state schools. Quite simply because, although perhaps the majority of parents who send their children to a denominational faith school denominational, pardon, they have accepted the faith stance of that school, but there are parents who send their child to a denominational school for non-faith reasons, perhaps because of the educational standards and achievements. Perhaps they're not able to get a place within a non-denominational school. The parent that I mentioned earlier, whose daughter has been threatened with exclusion, she sent her child to that school because that's where her friends went. There are a whole range of reasons why people send their children to certain schools. And ultimately, these schools are state-funded. They are open to everybody under the law. That is the demand. And parents who send their children to those schools should not have any less rights or any less protections than any other children within the state system.
And on that basis, then, I'm assuming that you're talking about amending the 1918 Education Act.
Yes.
1918 Education Act.
We've based it on the 1981.
But the 1918 Education Act, as I understand it, saw the creation of denominational schools in Scotland. And therefore, those denominational schools, the majority of denominational schools, are established under the 1918 Education Act.
Yes, the 1980 Education Act is the one that actually covers religious observance and what the rights are, and it specifies what the demands are. It's that act that we'd be looking to amend, which would basically change the situation. It would reverse the situation so that the parents who do want their children to take part in religious observance choose it.
That's all the questions I have.
Thank you. Unless members have any urgent points, the next step is looking how we deal with the petition. I think my view is that we should certainly continue the petition and seek the views of the Scottish Government, Education Scotland and the Scottish Parent Teaching Council. As always, I'm open to members of the committee. John Wilson.
Can I suggest, convener, we write to the Scottish Interfaith Council and ask them for their views? Particularly interested in seeking the views of a range of organisations within the Interfaith Council, because I know there are some associate members of the Interfaith Council that I would particularly wish to seek the views of, and that would include organisations such as the Pagan Federation, because I know that they have raised issues in the past regarding the teaching of education, the religious and moral values within schools. But I'd also suggest that, and I know there's been an exchange between the Clerk and the Edinburgh Secular Society in relation to submissions. Could I just make the general plea that if there are any other organisations who feel it, they think it's relevant to respond to this petition, that their submissions be welcomed as well, because we name a number of organisations, but we may not cover all organisations. Yeah. So it's just if any organisation out there wishes to comment, and I'm sure there will be a number of organisations who wish to comment, they're welcome to do so.
Thank you for that. Amit Taggart.
Thanks, Convener. I think it's also important that the Scottish Parent Teachers Council is ask for its views as well.
Yeah, thank you for that. And Jackson Carla?
I would be interested in exploring with local authorities the question of the provision of alternatives during the opt-out process, because that struck me as being not quite fulfilling the suitable, worthwhile alternative activity. So I'd be interested to know what the actual numbers of people opting out are, how a provision for an alternative suitable activity is established and conducted, whether in fact that's not happening because it's difficult to finance and sustain. And so I think there are some quite interesting issues around about all of that, because I'm left slightly uncomfortable with the idea that either resources are being diverted or that individuals are actually benefiting in no way whatsoever from being able to exercise an opt-out.
That's a good point. Perhaps if you'd like to say six local authorities, but vary with rural and island and busy city centre. John Wilson.
Could I suggest, convener, we also write to the EIS to ask them their views on this issue, and the Scottish Senior Head Teachers Association, I'm not sure of the acronym, yes, but it's the Scottish Senior and Head Teachers Association, because I think there's an issue from the educational's perspective, particularly given the petitioners raised the issue about the localised choice of head teachers and teaching staff within a school as to what they deliver in terms of religious and moral education and also religious observance.
Thank you for that. Any members have any other points? It's not really covered. So are members happy with our course of action, which is tenuous and to seek the views of the various organisations that we've identified earlier. And can I thank both our witnesses for coming along today. We'll keep you up to date with developments, and apologies again that you were held back because we were delayed with some earlier very lengthy petitions that we had. I won't suspend because of time constraints, but I'll allow our witnesses to leave. Thank you
very much.
If we just go on to third petition, it's PE 1484 by Ian Thoe, an independent regulator for national exams set by the Scottish Qualifications Authority. We've got the note and the SPICE briefing. My view is that we should continue this to seek the views of Scottish Government, Scottish Qualifications Authority and the Scottish Public Service Ombudsman. But welcome members' views.
No, I agree. I mean, this needs... The background here is deeply disturbing and deeply disconcerting as to... When I see tiers of management, you know, a chair, a board, then an advisory council, then an executive management team, that it may take 20 days to resolve an issue, and if it is unresolved, they then go to another part of the same organisation. You know, we really need to get into this one.
Good. Are members agreeable with that course of action? Thank you for that. Can we move to agenda item 4, consideration of current petitions. PE 1408 by Andrea MacArthur on the updating of pernicious anaemia, stroke vitamin B12 deficiency, understanding and treatment. Members have a note by the clerk. I think we had a debate in the chamber on this one. It was a very, very good petition. I would suggest we write to the British Council of Standards in Haematology and ask about guidelines on B12 and folate deficiency and the use of active B12, which I think are all quite important. I think, John Wilson, you had an interest in this.
Yeah. I did, convener, and it was just to support your suggestion for action, because we were advised in an earlier discussion at this committee that the report would be available during the summer. We've ended our summer. Clearly, we don't have the report as yet, and I would seek to support you in calling for the British Committee for Standards to give us an indication when the report will be available. And could I also suggest, convener, we write to the Scottish Government to ask the Scottish Government, in preparation of that report being imminent, how quickly they'll be able to report on the findings of the committee.
Members, happy with that course of action? Okay, thank you. Moving swiftly on to PE 1428 by Councillor Douglas Ferland on behalf of Argyll First and improvements to 83. Members will be aware, I think the Councillor gave a presentation to this committee on the issues around the 83. A lot of work's been carried out by the Scottish Government since then, and I would argue that in terms of the petition, we could close this on the basis that the Scottish Government have clarified the timescale in the 83 study report.
Agree.
Members happy with that? Thank you. PE 1457 by Alex Hamilton is Scotland's national tree. I wish to welcome an announcement today that the Scottish Government is to launch a consultation on having a national tree. I think that's very welcomed indeed. I'm sure members have their own views. So I would argue here that we could close this on the basis that the government has undertaken consultation, and this is very much in keeping with Alex Hamilton's request in this petition, so it actually meets the needs of the petition. John Wilson.
Could I suggest we also submit Mr Hamilton's submissions and the evidence we received to the Scottish Government as part of the consultation?
Just speaking personally, can I note it rather than welcome it, convener?
Does that mean you're pining for another tree? No.
That's why they changed the logo.
Angus
McDonald. Yeah, can I just draw attention to Alec Hamilton's comments from the 11th of August, in which he encourages us to make statements to the press, both local and national. So I, for one, will certainly be issuing a press release welcoming to the local media, welcoming or urging my constituents to engage in the consultation process. So.
Good. Thank you for that.
I would encourage others to do so.
And move on to PE 1467 by Andrew McGowan, member of the Scottish Youth Parliament, on behalf of the Scottish Youth Parliament on a Scottish Living Wage Recognition Scheme. Again, members have a note and submissions. I think, again, that the Youth Parliament's done a lot of good petitions here. Yeah. And whilst I think there probably was different views among the business community, I think it's probably useful to get some feedback from the Living Wage Foundation / Citizens UK who do the accreditation, because I think one of the main arguments is we don't want to set something else up, but let's see what the actual accreditation agency themselves say. They may feel this is an addition to make sure that employers look at living wage rather than something as an opposition. I just feel it's a bit of a... I think it would be a shame just to close this without doing that final piece of work. It's my own feelings. John Wilson?
I thought the submission from Peter Kelly, the Poverty Alliance, covered the issue about the Living Wage Foundation. And on behalf of the Scottish Living Wage Recognition Scheme, were basically supporting the idea that we actually continue to develop the foundation's role in encouraging employers to pay the living wage. So it's really whether or not we need to write to someone else before we close the petition, because I think it has been a worthwhile petition. It was interesting to see the CBI's response, not any news to someone like myself who's been involved in this campaign over a number of years. It's the same arguments that were being used about the introduction of the living wage. But really, I think we are in a position now where there is general recognition for the living wage, and it's really, we could close this petition now and move on.
Just to clarify, Mr. Wilson, did the Poverty Alliance speak on behalf of the Living Wage Foundation?
They spoke on, by my reading of it, they spoke on behalf of a number of organisations, including the SDUC, Scottish Churches, the GMB, PCS, Oxfam, and Child Poverty Action Group, and basically said that they already recognise the scheme and would urge any campaign to support further recognition through the scheme that's currently in place.
Thank you for that. Jackson Carlow.
I think it would be worth holding it open a little bit longer as well. I note the reported comments of the UK government who are about to announce incentives to employers to pay the living wage over above the national minimum wage. And I think it would be interesting to see what actions the UK coalition government are proposing to take to encourage a higher level of payment before we close this, to see whether there's anything in that that we might commend to the Scottish government as well.
Thank you for that. Anne McTaggart.
Just to say that it's been an outstanding petition, and thanks again to the, obviously, Andrew McGowan, who is along here today with the petition again. But for reasons that Jackson Carlow has also illustrated, I think it would be important for us to keep the petition open for those views.
In terms of, do you want us, Mr. Carlow, to actually write to the UK government to clarify? Yes. And the point about, I'm not totally convinced whether my point about Living Wage Foundation is covered or not, but I mean, I'm happy to accept John Wilson's points that it was covered in the Poverty Alliance paper. And
to the Living Wage Foundation, just to clarify that
it's not going to be in conflict with them. Because, right. So I understand the way it works is that the Citizens UK run the accreditation for the Living Wage through the Living Wage Foundation, but that's just a technical point. It just might be useful to get their view and take this back to a future meeting.
Yep.
Members be happy with that? And thank Andrew McGowan again, I think he's in the chamber today, for coming along. The next petition is PE 140 by Lauren King, again as member of the Scottish Youth Parliament, on behalf of the Scottish Youth Parliament on a Young Carers Grant. Members have a note by the clerk and submissions. And certainly I think it's, again, another good petition. It would seem to make sense to refer this to the Education Council Committee, because I think they're looking at the Children and Young People's Bill, aren't they, as we speak. Would members be agreeable to refer this on to this committee?
Yes.
Okay. And that's fine. And PE 1471 by Rachel McCulley, again, member of the Scottish Youth Parliament, who are, have got a bit of a dominance in these petitions today, on Young People's Hospital Wards. Members have a note by the clerk and submissions. Again, can I take views from members on next steps? I think we're still seeking responses from NHS Borders and Lothian. Do members wish to get a complete answer before we analyse this in full? I know it's a bit of a common view, which I know Chuck Brodie in particular is unhappy about delays, but I always believe we should get all the responses back before we do.
I agree, but I mean, we see three responsible petitions from the Scottish Youth Parliament. And I think it's incumbent that, and I won't bore everyone with speedy responses, but I think these are not, you know, sort of fly-by-night petitions.
Yeah.
They're serious petitions, and you know, we have to encourage, make sure that everybody understands they're serious, so that we can go back and address them. And I think we should certainly do that. And once we've done that, then seek clarification. I suggest to seek clarification with the government and NHS Education for Scotland. That's what we should. How we can then progress.
Thank you. Any other members? I'm a target.
Just to agree and thank again the petitioner for coming along to the gallery today for to hear the petition being actioned again. It would be important for to keep this petition open for all the reasons that has been given earlier.
Okay. Any other member? Dr. Carlo?
It seems to me from the range of responses that we've received that many of the health boards have told us what they do rather than what their particular response to the petition is, and in fact in some way seek to exercise a flavour, if I can call it that way, of the petitioner's request rather than necessarily the letter of it. So I think when we've collected all of this, what we won't actually have necessarily is a concise view of the nature of the petition, but of how young adults are treated within the system. And I think that at that point, probably it would be useful for the Health and Sport Committee to take a look at it and see what they feel should be done if there's a need to try and coordinate and bring about some national standard.
To contribute. Our members happy with the policy, and we're continuing this to seek the responses that are still outstanding and the additional ones that Chip Brodie raised. Thank you for that. And the final current petition today is PE1474 by David Milne on governance and propriety during the MENI development. Members have a note by the clerk and the submissions. Can I invite contributions from members on next steps for this petition? Jackson Carlow?
Police Scotland denied that they had been part of some major conspiracy, which I think was what was being suggested to us when we took evidence that they had been cooperating with the Mr. Trump's organisation in order to, in a discretionary basis, apply the law. And that seems to be the flavour of most of the other responses that we've had. And for those reasons, I'm actually in favour of closing this petition.
Members agreeable?
I agree. We need more than we would have needed more than this. We would have needed actual evidence, and there is none. And the responses have been, I think, attended to that, and therefore we should shut the thing.
Members agreeable? John Wilson?
Before we close it, could I ask whether or not David Millen responded to any of the submissions that we received?
He did, yes. Do you want something in front of it? All right. Members have the submission in the papers.
It's not being published.
But it's not being published.
Right. I'm just seeking clarification of whether or not we put it on the record that Mr. Milne did respond. However, there may be issues regarding some of the content of that response, so that we actually put that as a committee on the record. We have been accused as a committee of, in the past, by certain petitioners of being secretive in their deliberations. And it would be useful to, before we close this fully, that we fully understand that there was a submission made by Mr. Millen. However, because of some issues that have arisen because of that submission, it is not publicly available, but will become, or the hopefully the majority of that response will become available once some issues have been resolved.
Now, I think that's a perfectly fair point that John Wilson makes. So just record officially for the record that we have all received the feedback from David Milne, and the committee made a decision in light of that letter. There's some issues around the complete submission of that, and that will come out in due course, as John Wilson has said. So my view then is, after hearing the comments from everyone and the observations from the other public bodies, that there's little to demonstrate that another inquiry is necessary and that we should close this petition under Rule 15.7.
Yeah.
Agreeable? And we're still in public. Can I move on to agenda item 5, is correspondence. We did receive a letter from President of COSLA. You recall there's been some issues around us asking COSLA for responses, and for one reason or another, it's not always been we've not always been able to get that feedback in time for us to make further deliberations in the committee. And there's a suggestion that the Vice Convener and myself meet the President of COSLA to discuss that issue further. I obviously just want to seek the committee's agreement that the Clerk and Chip Brodie and I do meet the President of COSLA at their suggestion. and we'll obviously feed that back to a future meeting. John Wilson?
No comment at this moment, convener.
Okay, thank you for that. And could I formally close the meeting? Just ask members to stay behind for just a couple of minutes. There's nobody else in the gallery.